What goes on behind the scenes in Pacific politics and how does it affect us? Polytalk is back to unpack the big questions like, why is it hard to get medicine you need in the Pacific?
It came to a point where he was admitted where he got blood poisoning. He needed antibiotics for that, and that was not available.
Join me, Scott Whitehair, on Polytalk.
Search up Polytalk in your favorite podcast app to listen.
This is an ABC podcast.
Talofa, Malo, Bulavanaka, and good morning. This is Pacific Beats on ABC Radio Australia. It is Friday, December 19, the last work week for many as we head into the Christmas period. The news, however, does not stop and we have a big show coming up. We'll look at a new report outlining how nurses and doctors in the Pacific are being poached by Australia's labour mobility scheme. Also, why have chickens become the favoured method for smugglers transporting drugs into Samoa? And a big week of football ends on a sour note in Vanuatu, which will not host any OFC fixtures in 2026. We'll find out why today on the show. Pacific Beat comes to you from the lands of the Bunurong, Eburundjeri peoples of the Kulin Nation. Let's get started. But first, we begin in Tonga, where yesterday Lord Fakafenua was officially appointed Prime Minister by King Tupou VI at the Royal Palace. Earlier this week, he won the support of 16 out of 26 PMs in a secret ballot, defeating rival candidate and caretaker Prime Minister Esake Eke. Born in 1985, Lord Fakafenua is the youngest ever Tongan Prime Minister and only the second noble to lead the country since democratic reforms were introduced in 2010. Lord Fakafenua joins me this morning. Malauleli, Prime Minister, and congratulations on your election.
Thank you, Kyle. It's an honour to be on Pacific Beat such early in my term, and it's a real privilege to be on the show to bring some stability and continuity to the government of Tonga.
It's a privilege to have you here. Now, you framed your leadership bid around unity at a time of deep political division. What steps will this new government take to ensure unity across the nobles and the people's representatives?
A key feature of the political reform in 2010 has been instability of the last 15 years with consistent votes of no confidences. We've had many changes of government, and I think that stability in the House will reflect stability in the nation if we can try and unify everyone. So there are many aspects to this. My next steps as Prime Minister, now that I've been appointed by His Majesty, is to appoint my cabinet. And part of the consideration is trying to consider some of the opposition, whether it's appropriate to have them inside my cabinet, because there's the aspect of loyalty versus unity. And sometimes might be better to have them as a strong opposition to keep us accountable. But these are some of the considerations I haven't really made my mind up on. But that is definitely the platform that I was advocating for leading up to the election on Monday. But it's still an ongoing discussion, something that I'm carefully considering before Christmas.
Yeah, a lot's been made as to whether or not you would make, you know, former prime ministers as deputies or cabinet members or things like that. I mean, you spoke about some of those complexities. How are you going to navigate that sort of thing?
Very carefully, and it's quite a difficult thing. I don't think previous prime ministers even considered it. And it's something that I was quite genuine when I started off on Monday. So we'll see how it pans out. Obviously, I have my loyal supporters from the members of parliament who voted for me, and it would require giving up potentially one of their spots on cabinet to bring in someone who was actively against what we stand for. And that's probably one of the most difficult decisions that we have to consider before Christmas.
Now, in 2010, Thonga brought in democratic reforms that were meant to strengthen democratic representation and limit the power of the monarchy and nobility. You are a noble yourself. Thonga's crown prince is your brother-in-law, and you're a member of the royal family through your mother. How do you respond to concerns that, with you as prime minister, Thonga is sliding backwards with its democracy?
Look, in terms of sliding backwards, there haven't been any legislative changes or constitutional amendments to warrant such scaremongering. In 2010, we went through major political reform where the 9 people's representatives were increased to 17. The nobles' representatives were 9 in total before the democratic reform, and they maintained the status quo afterwards. And I believe that the reform that was intended by King George Debo V was implemented to give not only a greater voice to the people by increasing their representation from 9 to 17, but also give Parliament the authority to elect its Prime Minister from within the 26 members. And so it is the same democratic principle and same democratic constitution that we had in 2010 that we are now having in 2025. The major difference is that in our history there have only been one noble that was elected under that new system. In 2010 was Lord Duvaganore, and he was subsequently replaced by the pro-democracy advocate Akilisi Pohiva, who has now passed away. So since then, I'm only the second noble to be democratically elected under the 2010 reforms.
Yeah, it's really interesting. We spoke about some of those complexities a second ago about in terms of appointing your cabinet and things like that. But what about as a member of the nobility? You know, I guess transparency is not always a characteristic of nobility, generally speaking, across the world. I guess, how will you navigate what is, I guess, an inherent conflict of interest there?
There is no inherent conflict of interest. In terms of transparency, we are still accountable to the same rules, to the same laws, to the same constitution that all members of parliament, regardless of if you are a member of the nobility or not. If you're a people's representative, you're still under the same rules that guide transparency and good governance and accountability. That question came up in debate on Monday when we were electing the Prime Minister, and I responded by saying that we are still accountable to the same constitution, and as long as we remain accountable to the constitution, we are accountable like everyone else.
You're listening to ABC Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. I'm Kyle Evans, and I'm speaking with the newly elected Tongan Prime Minister, Lord Fakafenua. Prime Minister, I want to talk about some of the issues you've raised in the lead-up to becoming Prime Minister. The passport proposal to sell passports as part of a citizenship by investment scheme. Tonga has tried selling passports before, a scheme that became deeply controversial and was eventually scrapped amid concerns about corruption, loss of trust and damage to Tonga's international reputation. Given that history, where do you stand on it?
Look, I think that given the country's fiscal position, we've been running on a budget deficit and highly reliant on overseas donor support to prop up the government services. We have to be realistic about diversifying government's revenue and expanding our tax base, and we don't want to overburden the existing hardworking people of Tonga. And so we have to weigh every proposal on its merits. And at the moment, the current proposal that is being floated around, even though it was leaked from the previous government, it has its own merits. And I think if we process it through the appropriate channels, have it debated rigorously and put it through its vetting process, through public consultation and through Parliament, and if His Majesty approves it, then it might show some benefit to the country, given that we are about $1.3, $1.4 billion in infrastructure deficit, and that would help create a more resilient country. It would put us in good stead to support government services that our people, and especially the poor, we can help lift them with that much-needed foreign direct investment.
Just on those merits, how big is the financial benefit? Because Vanuatu, you know, they've learned the hard way how easily the scheme can be exploited by bad actors if not regulated properly. What are the benefits of such a scheme, and how do they outweigh the potential bad publicity that may come from it?
Look, I can't talk about specifics on the benefits, but so far from an initial standpoint, it seems like it far outweighs the risks. And I believe that given Tonga's bad history of passports in the past, the new proposal addresses and mitigates a lot of the risks in terms of money laundering and inviting the wrong type of people. And there are internal protections that exist today that didn't exist in the past. Now we have an Office of the Ombudsman, directly under the Parliament of Tonga. And now we have an anti-corruption commissioner that's been appointed, and that office is currently working to hold government and public service accountable. So there are certain mechanisms that we can introduce to help strengthen good governance and ensure that the money flows towards where it is appropriately required within government to support government services and also raise the standard of living for every Tongan.
I see. I want to switch gears again now. In an interview with Radio New Zealand in November, you said that the next Tongan government would need to focus on energy security after Tonga experienced weeks of fuel shortages. What are you now going to do to make sure Tongans have energy security?
Look, we just need to have a plan B, and that's what we experienced. One of the supply vessels was broken, and took a while for it to spin back up. Fortunately, the CEO of one of the oil depots has contacted me and assured that we will have continued supply through the Christmas period, and that the regularity of the ship is back on schedule. What we're going to look at is how to ensure that continued supply and stability and regulation is appropriately addressed so that we don't experience the fuel shortages that we've been seeing in the past couple of months. There's a technical aspect to it that I can't get into right now, but it's definitely on a priority list for the new government.
Let's talk about the youth aspect. You're a millennial prime minister yourself. Many young Tongans say their biggest concerns are work, housing, and the cost of living. What would be your top economic priority for youth in your first year, and what can young Tongans realistically come to expect?
Look, I think it's important, given the low turnout to our last elections in November the 20th, that we appropriately address the increasing divide and the loss of trust between millennials, young people, and our government. So I think we need to re-engage the youth. I think it's important for the new government to have a policy of meeting the youth where they are instead of expecting them to engage traditional bodies. We need to engage them on their platforms and speak their language. And I think, given that I am closer to their age than the rest of the leaders, that might help close that divide. In terms of the youth's priorities, the cost of living, health, access to jobs, that is all top on our priority. And we hope to achieve that by bringing a more efficient public service. There are certain low-hanging fruits where we can achieve that. Policy decisions available to Cabinet to increase the level of service and accessibility in terms of government payments. It might be ambitious to try and migrate government payments onto an online platform so people don't have to stand in line. This has a great impact on the economy as a whole, because then you're not spending times queuing up at the petrol station or to get a government service. If you can get it as quickly as possible, you can get back to being a productive citizen and contributing to our economy, opening new markets and encouraging foreign investment whilst protecting our local farmers and local produce. We need to create an environment conducive to doing business. And I think it's very important that we are as inclusive as possible. And that means considering the youth. And of course, we're challenged with the brain drain, not just in the labor force, but also our blue collar workers and even the public service. We're finding that they are increasingly being allured to the fruit picking and seasonal worker programs that are available in Australia and New Zealand. And that's just symptomatic of the low wages that we have here. So it's very important that we try and address that. And I don't blame people for trying to provide for their families. It's just that the environment here hasn't been so conducive in the past. And so we have to create an environment that is business friendly in Tonga and encourage the traditional industries that would bring growth and prosperity. And that is agriculture and tourism, and also look at planting the seeds for future economic sectors that might prove beneficial to the next generation.
And just finally, Mr. Prime Minister, there's a million challenges in the Pacific at the moment in relation to things like climate change, the labour mobility scheme, security. How do you intend to work with other Pacific leaders, and what role do you see Tonga playing in shaping regional priorities?
So part of Tonga's regional priority, along with the Pacific, is that we prioritise climate change as an existential threat. We are highly vulnerable to external shocks presented by climate impacts such as tropical cyclones, droughts, flooding, tsunami. We recently experienced in 2022 the effects of the Hunga Tonga, Hunga Hapai volcanic eruption. And what those experiences have really highlighted is that we have to look at building resilient infrastructure. And that means that we are not constantly being pulled back and spending the limited resources that we have rebuilding. And so when you look at economic development, we have to ensure that we have a strong foundation to build our prosperity on. And that's largely reliant on resilient infrastructure, infrastructure that we don't have to constantly repurchase after one of those climate events. And that's really what the $1.4 billion infrastructure deficit is all about. And that's something that I'm willing to have conversations with our partners in the neighbourhood. Australia is our largest donor partner right now, and I understand that this is one of the concerns that we'll be having with them. Australia is, and New Zealand are currently building our parliament building after it was razed to the ground by Tropical Cyclone Geeta in 2018. And so we're very grateful for that assistance, but that parliament building has been moved from the waterfront to a much higher area that's more resilient so that we don't experience that in the future. So that's just one example of some of the challenges and plans for the future we need to look at. Airports and wharfs, and creating facilities that our people can enjoy in the changing climate and the global space that we're experiencing right now.
And just quickly, for all the young people that might be listening, you spoke a little bit earlier about your plans to engage them. Does that mean we can see you on, we can find you on TikTok sometime soon?
I am not on TikTok, so that might be a new experience, but I'm not close to the idea. At the moment, I'm regularly engaging with one of the local radio stations that's popular with the youth platform, and I think I'm going to continue doing that as Prime Minister.
Oh, that's good to hear. Mr. Prime Minister, that's all we've got time for, but thank you very much for joining us today on Pacific Beat, and good luck with forming your upcoming administration.
Thank you. It's been an honour, and I'm happy to be with ABC Pacific Beat.
Thank you. That was Lord Whakawhanua, Tonga's new Prime Minister.
Rout Lemon Cut, Jacob Maguire here from Nisha Daily. Yes, still broadcasting, still caffeinated, and still yapping.
Uh-huh, and I'm Michael Chow, and as we wrap up the year, we just want to say a massive thank you for tuning in.
From Timor-Leste to the Cook Islands and everywhere in between, we hope your holidays are full of good vibes, good company, and a good amount of sleep after a good amount of feasting.
From all of us at ABC Radio Australia, stay safe, stay happy.
And if you're regifting presents this year, we promise not to judge.
See ya in 2026.
Welcome back to Pacific Beat. I'm Kyle Evans, and the Pacific is facing a health crisis, the result of nurses and doctors being poached by Australia's Labor Mobility Scheme. A new report has found that an exodus of skilled health workers heading to Australia for better pay and conditions has seen Pacific countries losing up to 40% of their workers. Lucy Cooper has this report.
It's a common theme in the Pacific: hospitals with outdated equipment and facilities struggling to cope with a growing population. But now there's a further problem. Pacific countries are losing skilled nurses to Australia. Fiona McDonald, the Director of Future Work at the Australia Institute, says some health services are on the brink of collapse.
We'd heard stories of dire circumstances where health workforces are in shortage in those countries, and also in a context of underfunded services that were really struggling. One of the reasons why those systems are struggling is because of the loss of experienced and skilled workers.
Their new report is based on consultations with Pacific workers, union representatives and the Australian government. It found an exodus of skilled nurses and doctors joining the Pacific Australia Labour Mobility Scheme.
You lose highly skilled workers to other countries because there's more opportunities for them. They earn a lot more money than they would in poorer countries in the Pacific.
Many of these workers are heading into Australia's aged care industry, where there is a critical shortage of workers. Aged care workers make up 4% of the 30,000 workers in the scheme. But when Pacific nurses get into Australia, Fiona McDonald says they do get better pay, but their new jobs are well below their skills level.
It's a brain drain, but it's also just a loss of skills overall. It's not that the skills from the Pacific are being utilised effectively and people are being recognised for their skills when they migrate. They're actually being recruited into a lower skilled job. The brain drain impact on the country's health systems is enormous.
Since 2023, Australia and Palm Scheme partner countries have implemented the Aged Care Expansion Program, which supports new Palm aged care workers to complete a Certificate 3 in individual support. But in Vanuatu, the health ministry is struggling to keep its workers. Beverly Bully is the administrator of the Vanuatu Association of Public Service and has witnessed the exodus of nurses.
Some health workers, they leave the health system and they work somewhere else because they are not happy with what's going on inside the administration or the management because of its weakness.
It's a similar situation in Fiji.
We are losing our very experienced and highly qualified nurses, especially our nurse unit managers and our team leaders. And they've opted to leave the country to pursue greener pastures abroad.
That's Philomena Talawandua, the General Secretary of the Fiji Nursing Association.
The concern that we have is they are qualified nursing managers. They're going to work in Australia as caregivers, and they will only work within the scope of what is there for them in the institutions that they're now working in. They will lose out on their clinical experience as registered nurses.
She says the Palm Scheme isn't supposed to take workers already employed as nurses in the Pacific to avoid a brain drain.
We have had recruitments in the country where institutions have come in to recruit our nurses. And that is something that baffles us, that between the two countries and the agreement that was reached, this had happened. And we've raised this and they're looking into this.
She says it's the team leaders, middle managers and nurse unit managers who are relied on to guide the next generation of healthcare workers who are joining the Palm Scheme.
We've had to have some of these very senior nurses rostered to doing overtime. But the situation we are facing right now is, again, we're having problems with the payment of overtime because of the budget allocation. We cannot stop them from leaving. They're leaving for reasons that they felt was best for them to leave the country, to pursue working out there in the receiving countries. They get better pay. Some of them are very pleased with the conditions that they have.
In a statement to the ABC, a spokesperson for Australia's Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade said that improving education and skills outcomes in Pacific countries is key to strengthening domestic labour markets, and that Australia's Development Assistance Program responds to partner government priorities by investing in programs to strengthen health workforce capability in Pacific Island nations. Philomena Talawandua said she would like to see the sending and receiving countries come to a compromise.
These nurses that are coming out to work in the receiving countries, they were trained by us. They were born here. They were raised here. They were given their values and the principles that they take across with them. They were nurtured. They were guided. They were upskilled clinically. We're training them at our cost and at the expense of our taxpayers of our, this country. And all we get in the end is that they leave. And we keep training our people at our cost. And if we continue with this trend, then we hate to imagine what is going to happen.
Fiona McDonald of the Australia Institute says there needs to be reforms with the PALM scheme.
We're recommending that labour agreements that are between the Australian and New Zealand governments and the Pacific Island countries need to be much more holistic, and there needs to be some policy coherence in those labour agreements. We think they should involve unions, trade unions in those countries that are representing health workers in the planning and implementation of schemes, so that there's a better understanding of what's going on, and also thinking about migration in the context of what's happening in the health sectors.
That was Lucy Cooper with that report. Switching to sport now, and it's been good news and bad news for Vanuatu fans in the Soccer Mad Nation this week. On one hand, the nation's first ever professional team, Vanuatu United FC, held their official launch ahead of the inaugural OFC Pro League, set to kick off next month. On the other hand, word dropped that Vanuatu had been excluded from hosting any OFC tournaments in 2026. Local media have reported Vanuatu's facilities have failed to meet FIFA standards, but the country's football governing body says these reports are inaccurate. To set the record straight, we are joined by the General Secretary of the Vanuatu Football Federation, Albert Manarotto.
There's more to that. I think this is more to it than just, you know, not meeting standards. I mean, you really have to go back and look at, I mean, we are part of the, you know, everything that happens in Vanuatu, whether it's in good times or whether it's in disaster times. So I think, you know, we hosted in 2023 the OFC Champions League, mm-hmm. and in 2004 the Nations Cup. So basically, it's only this year and next year, but that is understandable because you would have to apply for hosting in 2024 for 2026. And we were in between two cyclones, the 2023 and then the earthquake in 2025. There was a lot of uncertainty, particularly in terms of the hotels.
I see.
Damaged hotels. And then also, you know, in 2024, we had a disruption, which we wanted to host part of the Champions League, the Nations Cup in Santo. We couldn't do that because the airline suddenly ceased operations. And then, you know, after the earthquake, there's a lot of things impacted on basically the economic decision, whether it was right to try to think that we should be ready by 2026. That's a lot of risk to take.
Absolutely.
A lot of hotels, I believe, are still recovering. And, you know, with the damages and the airline, but in terms of shipping and in the airline, you know, the supply chain mechanism is, you know, has created a lot of havoc in terms of, you know, things like construction material,
which has
a lot to do with reconstruction. That's the one part. The other part is when you look at in terms of the priority, national priorities. You know, all of investment would have gone, even with the government, would have gone through putting back services in place, you know, infrastructure and food security and all of that stuff. So I think it was a decision basically made, one, because we couldn't have done it because we were not in a position to do it in 2024, to apply for it, because we had the earthquake and kind of the two cyclones in 2023. To assume that things would have been 2026 would be reaching out into the dark in a way. So, but we are keen to go back in 2027. I think we've made that point clear to OFC in our applications. We would like to host at least a few tournaments in 2027. So I think it's basically a period now we're going through with the country is going through, and it's affecting everybody, particularly in terms of inflation. And there's a lot of uncertainty in the way you want to run tournaments. So it's basically down to the economy that has, as Allah has made it difficult for us to make that choice.
Yeah, I see. So it sounds like it's a lot more complicated than just infrastructure limitations. That we're talking about flow-on effects from not one but two disasters and the impacts that's had on things like hotels and accommodation and all the things that make it possible to host a large-scale event. Is that essentially what it is?
Yes. There's a lot of it. It's basically to do with the whole, and especially when you talk about Port Vila, and it's basically just recovering. I mean, you're looking at the road repairs now, but there's no the new buildings, the hotels, no, all these things are not yet in place. But I'm sure in 2026, it is projected that there'll be more activity in 2026. And we also think that, in 2027, we would want to host. But it's just unfortunate that we couldn't do it this time because it's just not feasible.
Yeah,
that's basically the reality of the matter.
And how much damage did your soccer facilities or your football facilities actually take?
We have basically, the Federation has basically two facilities. There's one in first for the stadium. And then we have another one in Santo. But like I told you, it's basically out of reach now because you cannot practically, book airlines. Because we only have one, Solomon Airlines goes probably once a week to Santo. So these are the only two we manage. The other ones are government facilities. But again, you have to look at how the government prioritizes its infrastructure programs, particularly in terms of recovery, in terms of after disasters. So we assume that after 2025, the government will probably be in a position more to look at, sporting facilities. And I think the government has made its point very clear to the Football Federation that they will work together to ensure to facilitate this. But the Pro League has given a new dimension as to, why it needs investment in this area. Because it becomes a viable option to take now rather than if there was none.
I see. Yeah. So because some of those stadiums, I guess, such as Cormann Stadium, which has a 6,000, 5,000 person capacity, because they're government owned, I suppose that complicates it a bit more in terms of getting them fixed because it's got to come from, I guess, government money. Is that the case?
Yes. That's basically the reality of the fact here. I mean, we have to, when we used to hire in the past, we had to hire those stadiums. And there would be inspections there to actually see that they meet the standards. And if they do not meet the standards, and then, it's difficult to, because we couldn't be spending on funds. And as you well know, most of the countries in the region rely on our partners in terms of funding, but are restricted very much in the way where you want to spend them. So it's basically down to the reality of the matter at the end of the day.
That was General Secretary of the Vanuatu Football Federation, Albert Manarotto. Pacific Beat. Well, the Samoan government is stepping up its war on drugs, ordering police to be armed during raids. The move comes after recent seizures of illegal substances hidden in boxes of chicken at the border. The Samoan Prime Minister says tackling drug trafficking is now a top priority. To discuss, I'm joined now by Team Leader of Addiction Services with the Salvation Army, Tino Senio, who works with offenders referred by the Samoa Court. Malo, Tino, and welcome to Pacific Beat.
Thank you for having me on your show.
No, not a problem at all. Now, we've covered plenty of stories of drug trafficking across the Pacific, but this may be a first with drugs discovered inside a shipment of frozen chickens and imported from American Samoa. I suppose, what was your reaction when you first heard about that?
Well, as a service provider, I guess I can say I was very disappointed. The police and customs officers are doing their best, but these things are still coming through, and so very disappointed and angry at the same time, because these people are are not actually looking at the impact of bringing these illicit drugs in the country. And, you know, vulnerable people, Samoa is a small country with a big problem now. So, yeah, very concerning and disappointed and angry at the same time as a service provider, because we're seeing people that are coming through with very severe problems in regards to drug addictions and alcohol issues.
Yes, well, in relation to those chickens, I've got to say it surprised me when I read about it the first time it happened in October, but it shocked me even more when it happened again last week, soon after a previous attempt was foiled. And I guess given just that brazenness, it makes me wonder if other attempts have been successful. Have you seen evidence on the ground to suggest that there's been an increase of drugs in the community?
Yes, a lot of young people, because we are seeing some, and then we hear stories from those that we are seeing that there's kids 15-year-olds they're using, and they are into other stuff as well, you know, with young girls prostituting, you know, with prostitution just to, you know, to fund their habits. So, and I've interviewed one particular young girl, and I was very saddened by what she said. She said that, you know, she has a group of friends that they're all into the same thing and doing the same thing that she was actually telling me. So very concerning. You know, my heart goes out to these young kids, and that's what these other those other people that are bringing the drugs in are not actually looking at. They're just looking at making money, easy, fast money, but they're not looking at the impact of their behavior and bringing in this illicit drugs.
No, you're right, and it's horrible. I mean, we've seen other Pacific countries become a target for drug smugglers or people transiting drugs through the region, and we've seen the horrible impact it's had, because it leads to an uptick in drugs within those communities. Is anything similar happening in Samoa, do you think, with Samoa potentially being used as a transit point?
Yes, well, we're now both a market and a transit point. Before it was just a transit point, but now, you know, the market is here, and we are actually hearing stories and seeing a lot of people using and under the influence, and also the increase in the rates that the police are doing, and there's always methamphetamine and firearms, you know, being confiscated from those rates. And it's pretty much every week now. It's every week occurrence with, you know, the local dealers and those people.
You might not know, but I'm curious as to why American Samoa is featured so prominently in these headlines, and why there seems to be drugs coming from there. Do you have any idea?
Well, I think you know, we go back. We go back a long time with the history of American Samoa being one of the where the drugs are coming through to Upolu and Western Samoa. So I don't know how the drugs are getting into American Samoa, but I hear stories that American Samoa is one of the places where the drugs are coming from. And so, you know, with the cases with the frozen chicken, and I think, you know, I hear from other people that, you know, the fishing boats that go out, you know, they do exchange out in the ocean, and then they bring the stuff back in from American Samoa. So that's what I'm hearing from my sources.
Yeah. Oh, I see. Antino, one of the horrible consequences of this trafficking across the Pacific has been this increase in HIV. Have you noticed an increase, particularly in intravenous drug use within the Samoan community these days, I guess compared to what they might have been 10 years ago?
No, I haven't actually heard anything, and I haven't seen anything here, but it will be coming. You know, it will be here in Samoa. So if we don't do something now, you know, 2-3 years' time, it will be something that we'll be facing, like Fiji. We know it's bad in Fiji, but there's nothing stopping it coming to Samoa if we don't do anything about this right now.
And how prepared are services like yourself, you know, to deal with a potential, you know, onslaught of drugs in the future? Do you have funding? Do you have staff to be able to offer services?
That is a very good question. At this stage, we're actually funded by InfaT New Zealand, and so that funding is stopped now. There's talks about InfaT New Zealand funding Tonga, Fiji, and Samoa. But at this stage, we are not getting anything from the government. We've been here since 2018, and we have been working very hard trying to help our people. But unfortunately, we haven't received anything from the government. So I guess there's a conversation with the Prime Minister, maybe next year. But, you know, funding is a major challenge because we can't actually support our people without the resources that we need.
And just finally, Tino, what role do churches and NGOs and village leaders, even families, play in terms of prevention? Can they help?
Yeah, well, churches, they need to put their hand up, and you know, the village councils, because you know, you can't actually do anything without the churches, the village councils, you know, the NGOs are supporting these persons. I know, you know, the police are doing their playing their part. The government are giving out these initiatives, but then it's the churches and the villages that are the people that can actually make it work, and they will make a big that will make a big difference.
That's encouraging to hear. Tino, that's all we've got time for today. But thank you so much for joining us on Pacific Beat.
My pleasure. Thank you for inviting me.
Not a problem at all. That was Tino Senio from Samoa Addiction Services and team leader for the Salvation Army. It is Friday, December 19, and you're listening to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. It has been a busy show so far, to say the least, but just a quick recap of our top story. We spoke with the newly appointed Tongan Prime Minister, Lord Whakawhanua, who has promised to unite the Legislative Assembly by attempting his very best to navigate those complexities in regards to the people's representatives as well as the nobilities. We also looked at a new report outlining how nurses and doctors in the Pacific are being poached by Australia's labour mobility scheme. Stick around though, because up next we're going to head to Vanuatu, where another vote of no confidence is being tabled against the PM.
You're listening to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
Welcome back to Pacific Beat. Well, today, Vanuatu's Prime Minister Jotham Nupat is facing a vote of no confidence. In November, opposition leaders had filed a notice for a no confidence vote, and it was dismissed by the Speaker of Parliament. But the Supreme Court ordered Parliament to meet and hold the vote. For the latest details, I'm joined now by our reporter in Vanuatu, Lily Rose. Well, Lily Rose, welcome back to the program.
Good morning, Kyle.
Now, why has this vote of no confidence been called?
Well, the opposition says the Prime Minister's leadership has raised serious concerns. They point to the issuing of a diplomatic passport to a special envoy in 2023, allegations that the Prime Minister benefited from the appointment, and the government's refusal to release a commission of inquiry report into the citizenship program, and claims of ministerial post and spending concern concentrated on one island, which raises fairness and regional balance issues. The motion also highlights that the ongoing teacher strike, which has disrupted schools nationwide, and they argue that the government has failed to respond even after court rulings confirmed that the strike was lawful.
And what do we know about who has the numbers at the moment? Can Mr. Nupat survive this vote, do you think?
Well, both sides are projecting confidence. The government has come out and they have posted the picture of all of them united, and they say they have the numbers to defeat the motion, while the opposition is also claiming numbers and is confident that it can secure enough votes to bring down the Prime Minister. With Vanuatu coalition politics, they're complex, so alliances can shift quickly. So the final result will depend on how MPs vote in Parliament, on the floor in Parliament.
And what time will all this happen, Lily Rose?
That will be 9 a.m. this morning.
Okay, really interesting. Well, look, I'll tell you what, Lily Rose, we might just leave it there for now, but we'll certainly be watching very closely to see how it all unfolds. Thanks very much for joining us on Pacific Beat today.
You're welcome.
That was Lily Rose Wellwell speaking to me there from Port Vila. Meanwhile, Vanuatu continues to feel the aftershocks, both literally and emotionally, of the devastating 7.3 earthquake that rocked Port Vila one year ago. Just yesterday, a 5.5 earthquake shook the capital again, and for many, it stirred up memories and fears of the 14 killed and hundreds injured this time last year. Our reporter Max Walden spoke with Save the Children Vanuatu Country Director Polly Banks about how this emotional week is playing out for those in Port Vila.
When I talk to my friends and colleagues from Vanuatu, there's still just the shock of it happening and the devastation, of course, of the loss of lives, as well as the impact that the earthquake has had on livelihoods and on buildings. But particularly that shock, I think, you know, we had another 5.5 magnitude earthquake, but kind of reinforces that fear regularly with all of these aftershocks. And the Pacific is just so well versed in preparing for cyclones and the time that you get to prepare and hunkering down and doing all the right things. But of course, with an earthquake, you can't prepare in the same way because of the immediacy of earthquakes. So I think still that ongoing fear is ever present. And so many colleagues as well and friends have told me just how sad it is, really heartbreaking to drive through town and to see so many iconic buildings that are being demolished or have already been demolished because they're no longer safe. So it's just completely changed the way that the city looks. And for children, it really is that fear of future earthquakes comparative to their experience of cyclones and also the loss of so many schools that are being rebuilt now. And it was really at the memorial. We also held a staff memorial to speak through everybody's memories. And there were such courageous stories shared about what they experienced and what staff did in the minutes after the earthquake, but also just reinforcing that fear and that shock because of the lack of preparation that everyone felt and continues to feel.
We've spoken to quite a few new Vanuatu that have complained that the pace of recovery has been too slow and, you know, in many cases that's affected their livelihoods, especially if they're sort of small business owners. What are some of the reasons for that, you know, that the slow pace of rebuilding and recovery?
The recovery from an education perspective is definitely getting there and we've had really good support from the Ministry of Education. But this is a country that's one of the most vulnerable countries in the whole world to the impact of climate change and climate-induced disasters. And so Vanuatu is just constantly in a state of rebuilding. And so while the earthquake wasn't a climate-induced disaster, it is compounded by the impact of climate-induced disasters. I began in 2023, and I can see the rebuilding still happening from tropical cyclones Kevin, tropical cyclone Judy, and tropical cyclone Lola, and now the earthquake. But also there's localized disasters that are happening as well. Just in Umbai right now, there's a volcanic eruption or some disturbance to the volcano there that's leading to ash fall that's affecting people's water supply. So the vulnerability to non-climate-induced disasters plus climate-induced disasters means that this cycle of constantly rebuilding requires a lot of funding to be able to meet the demand and coordination of how to spend that in a way that's ethical and accountable for the funding that comes in.
And obviously this week we did hear that news from the Asian Development Bank around a grant focused on the sort of rehabilitation of Port Vila's walls. But my understanding is that the landslide there kind of remains in place. For me, that raises the question, have international partners, including Australia, kind of acted quickly enough to assist Vanuatu get on its feet, given that that would appear to provide quite a sort of a roadblock to economic recovery, certainly?
Yeah, look, from my lens, I think international partners acted really quickly. We had funds within weeks for our immediate response, and then significant funds come in within a matter of about 2 months for much more broad infrastructure rebuilding. And with that, we were, in the short term, we were able to set up child-friendly spaces. We were able to distribute household items like tarpaulins and household kits. We distributed the Library for All books that I mentioned, and now we're doing classroom rebuilding. So that funding came in really quickly. From my lens, the international community has been pretty quick to respond with funding. I know the Australian government's given about $28 million of funding for the response and the recovery in total, and about $4.5 million of that went to clearing the Wharf Road, and that goes through government. So the government has rigorous tendering processes. So when they receive that enormous amount of funding, and keep in mind they've got funding from previous disasters that they need to be accountable for as well, they run their tender process to ensure fairness and equity in awarding these large-scale tenders. And these processes are designed to ensure that these taxpayer dollars from the international community are spent in such a way that it's accountable. So although I don't know why the delay has been, I suspect it's because of the processes to make it done in a way that's accountable. And I know that the particular contract for not just ADBs, but the contract for clearing the wharf and getting it up and ready has been awarded now through that central tender board, and that work's beginning this month.
That was Save the Children Vanuatu Country Director Polly Banks speaking there with Max Walden.
Kick off your Sunday with Kuntamari Crofts on Pacific Sundays right here on ABC Radio Australia. Pacific Sundays is a laid-back weekly wrap of all things Pacific, from news, sport and entertainment to the best island music vibes. So whether you're chilling out, heading off to church or catching up with family, be entertained as you do it with Pacific Sundays. Every Sunday at 6 a.m. PNG time on ABC Radio Australia.
And that does bring us to the end of Pacific Beat today, but we'll be back at the same time Monday morning. That's 6 a.m. PNG time. You can also hear us again this afternoon at 5 p.m. PNG time. That'll be with Aggie Dubol. Stay tuned, though, on ABC Radio Australia because the news is next. And coming up after that is Nija Daily. You'll find all our top stories on our website. Just type Pacific Beat and Radio Australia into your search engine or via the ABC Pacific page, which is at www.abc.net.au/Pacific. My name's Kyle Evans. Have a fantastic day.